Welcome to the Whiskey, Jazz, and Leadership Podcast. Subscribe now so you don't miss a drop of straight talk you can't get anywhere else. We discuss the whiskeys to drink, music to listen to, and what it really takes to be an effective leader. I'm your host, Galen Bingham, the Leadership Strategist. Tonight's guest, Global Negotiation Strategist and partner of the GAP Partnership, Scott Chapow. Hey, what you drink? We've had conversations with all kinds of people, and we have taken you all around the world. And I pride myself at having a very, very broad Rolodex. Can we say Rolodex anymore? I don't even know if people even know what Rolodex even is anymore. But I've got a lot of friends from all over in a variety of different industries. And with this conversation, I'm going to take you into one of the people who really, he's really kind of taking a space in my brain. Anytime I go into a business situation where there's some strategy involved or some negotiation involved, this is one of the dudes that I think about. I'm just so excited to share with you this conversation with Mr. Scott Chapow. Scott, welcome to the show, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing amazing, Galen. Thanks so much for having me with you today. And I appreciate that spot in your brain.
Yeah, boy, well-earned spot too, well-earned spot. You and I met back in 2018, and we're going to get into this special thing that you do because you've got an expertise that I don't know that people really appreciate how much work goes into training a professional negotiator. But that's what you do, man. So I want to definitely share that because I think there might be some whiskey involved. I think there might be some jazz involved. There's definitely some leadership, but we're going to get into that, man. First question though, and everyone seems to know that this is the most important question. So here we go. So what you drinking?
Oh, I have a delicious glass of Pendaren Welsh whiskey. I'll give you a little insight into this one. So I'm actually an Irish whiskey guy. And a few years ago, one of my Welsh colleagues introduced me to Pendaren as the only Welsh whiskey there is. And I happened to be, he told me it's very, very expensive. And I was passing through Heathrow the next day and I grabbed a bottle of duty free. And I looked at it, I don't think you understand how much whiskey costs in the United States. This is pretty darn cheap. And ever since then, whenever I pass through Heathrow, I pick up a couple bottles because it is delicious.
Oh my gosh. Pendaren. I know that I've never tried it. I don't think I've ever heard of it. So I'm definitely going to have to put that on my list for my next trip to London because that sounds amazing. Again, I put a lot of thought into the whiskeys that I bring out when I've got guests here with me. And you tend to be kind of foundational in my head, in my brain, you know, because there is nothing that you can do in a given day where there isn't some sort of negotiation. And I often have to think about our time together. Since this is going to be a foundational conversation, I had to go back to the foundation of my appreciation for whiskey. And the story is when I decided to get something a little bit more expensive, something that was behind the case, they had like a special lock that you had to get someone to come and get. One of the first times I did that, I grabbed a bottle of Jefferson's Reserve single barrel. And this was so special that I would literally only bring it out when I had someone special coming over, and we would keep this in the freezer. So there would be no need to add ice. There's no need to mess around with stones or cubes or any of that stuff. You just pour this and just let it do what it do. So this was my freezer whiskey for special occasions. And so I'm going to break this out now. This is Jefferson's Reserve, single barrel, very old Kentucky straight bourbon. And this is 100 proof. Right, so this is some grown folks stuff, but I'm gonna go ahead and crack a little bit of this open. So and pour me just a little. And, you know, I'm going to enjoy this gingerly, because at 100 proof, you know, I can't just like knock this back. But while I enjoy this, and I see you enjoying your Pandaren over there, while I'm enjoying this, share a little bit with our audience as to who you are and how do you end up doing the kind of work that you do, because I don't know that the average person would even think of yours as a career to even think about getting into. So take us a little bit on the journey, and we'll hook up on the other side of this taste.
Totally, I can answer that question. So for me, I started my career, actually I took a few years off before I even started my career. I like to refer to it as retired young. I actually moved out to Colorado, lived in a ski town for a few years, and then got my first job in sales. Actually, I was a consultant before I even did that. Worked in sales in the consumer goods space in the beverage industry, then jumped over to OTC Pharma, and then to the complete dark side in RX Pharma, where I spent the bulk of my career. Sales training, sales strategy, worked for Wyeth, which is now part of Pfizer these days, and AstraZeneca. Kind of grew up in the sales realm, doing business development, account management. And as I always put it, one of my employers was kind enough to pay for me to get my master's degree and not kind enough to let me use it. So I jumped ship and then become a consultant, sales and marketing process consulting. For those of you who know me well, they'll get a chuckle at that statement. Eventually, I actually just started a new role. You know, I was in a training class. And I got a call from London, and I kind of sent a voicemail. And a couple of seconds later, I got an email asking me if I would chat about a new role. I had literally just joined a new company. Turned out it was the Gap Partnership. And you know, they talked to me about negotiation consulting, and I didn't actually know that was a job. I mean, I've been negotiating all my career. You know, I joined the company. It was a really quick process. It was quick for me. It depends on, you know, your timing and so on. Just so happened it was snowmageddon on the East Coast, so there was nothing else to do but take some calls. And the next thing I knew, I was on a flight to London, and I've been here 8 glorious years, working with some of the coolest people, some of the largest clients across the globe, and helping them develop their organizational negotiation capabilities. On a personal level, based outside Philadelphia and the Western foothills. For those of you who've been out this way, the roads here are like goat paths. So they're narrow, old, and I'm married. You will never see my wife. One of our clients just accused me of keeping her locked in the basement. That is not true. She got a chuckle at that one. I've got 2 kids. My daughter is going to be 17. My son's about to be 20, and I've got 2 dogs. Which, Galen, I'm going to apologize because they'll inevitably bark during our conversation for that.
That's all right, man. Bring them in, man. As soon as they need to let you know that there's a box outside, we need to know that too. You know, I usually hit this towards the end of our conversation, but you're someone I'd love to get your take on this very early on, because I think this might set up a good part of our conversation. And that is helping me to explain the connection between the 3 elements of this podcast name. I put all 3 together because I enjoy all 3 literally. So whiskey, jazz, leadership. I enjoy all 3 literally. But I also enjoy the metaphor. And so for me, the metaphor of whiskey is doing what you enjoy with people you enjoyed with, irregardless of what other folks think, right? If they don't get it, they don't get it. This isn't about them anyway. The metaphor of jazz is getting from where you are to where you need to be, although there may not be sheet music in front of you and things might not be spelled out. There may not be a gold line course for you to follow. And the metaphor of leadership is marketing is fun, strategy is important, but nothing happens until somebody does something. Someone needs to stand up and say, unless we get a better answer, we're going to go left, and we're going to go left in 3 minutes, right? Someone needs to take action and start, or else nothing is going to get done. So for me, that's the metaphor. Now, you're a negotiation strategist. You're a pretty smart dude. How does that metaphor fit? Does that make sense in anyone's head other than my own? And how does that relate to what you do?
So it does. It does make sense to me, exactly what you're saying from the whiskey, jazz, and leadership perspective. How does it relate to what I do? And so for me, every day is an adventure. Even though you think you've heard it all in the world of negotiation, you have not. Every day I'm confronted with new complex variety of problems. And for me, when I think about whiskey, when I think about jazz, when I think about leadership, that's not a simple concept. Whiskey's complex and there's complex notes to it. Jazz, to be fair, I'm not exactly a jazz aficionado. I love music and I appreciate jazz. But jazz is, to your point, how do you get from point A to point D? And what's the pathway you take in between? You think about acid jazz and it's all over the place. It's complex. It's hazy. Leadership is the same thing. There is no easy way to get from point A to point D. You deal with people, and hence the point of being a leader. And every single person you deal with, whether it's internally or externally, will have their own emotions, their own complexity that you have to navigate. For me, it's about what's the right type of leadership to take to utilize, how complex does that need to be, and how do I take that haze of the whiskey and the jazz and bring it to the light of day so that people understand exactly the strategic perspective and how to get to the end of the line. Negotiation's a bit different though. Negotiation is a bit different. There's always a leader in negotiation. Sometimes you don't even know who it is. Mm-hmm. And when you think about that aspect of it, it's super complex. It's super hazy. Unless, of course, you're buying something off the street in Morocco or something like that, where it's pretty simplistic. But when you think about corporate negotiation, it's complex and that's hazy, and it needs a guide to get you to the end.
I love your introduction of the word hazy, because that really does, that fits this conversation. And, one of the key points that I remember from my time with you, and to set the stage, okay, so back in my days in corporate, I'm working for the Coca-Cola company, and I'm in this role where I'm supposed to be training the organization on how to do a variety of things. It's a temporary spot because at the time I'm not a training dude, right? I'm an ex-sales guy. I'm an ex-leader in this temporary spot. And one of the people that they said that we should go talk with to learn how to negotiate better, but really think about how to train the rest of the organization on negotiating, and that is the Gap partnership. And so, I went in with a bit of arrogance. I went in kind of feeling like, I've negotiated before. I've negotiated millions of dollars worth of contracts. I kind of know what this is about. But boy, the experience that you put us through really did enlighten how important it is to not go into a negotiation with any kind of hate, as much clarity as you possibly can have. That's what you should be seeking to have. And I just think about how you really did think through not only, and here's where I got this analogy, the classical part of negotiation, which is understanding the parameters, understanding the numbers, understanding whatever you can, having a plan, right? That's classical. But then being open to the jazz part of it, when things don't go according to plan, which, by the way, things never go according to plan, but just being open to this idea of jazz. Talk a little bit about how you see negotiation training in particular to this idea of classical music, having a plan, but then being open to jazz, being open to moving where the opportunity might be or what the other person might be looking for. How does that classical and jazz music fit with negotiations?
Oh, it's a great question. And I love the metaphor. So for me, Oftentimes, when we're going through the hiring process of the Gap partnership, someone will say to me, "I was born to be a negotiator. I always wanted to be a negotiation consultant," and I automatically cross them off the list because I know they're lying to me. There's very few people that wanted to be a negotiator when they were born, and even fewer that knew that the role of negotiation consultant existed. When we think about how that music flows and how it comes off the page, look. Negotiation is 90% preparation. It is. The more you prepare, the better off you'll be. When you get in the room, things are going to go wrong. They always do. I think Mike Tyson says it best, and I got to give him the quote. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. In negotiation, you can have the best plan in the world, but you're going to get punched in the mouth. How you navigate through that, it will dictate the outcome. So when you go through negotiation preparation, part of it's about what can go wrong, how you deal with things when they go wrong before they even happen. So hopefully when you get there, most of those things will not go wrong. But when they do, you're already confident in the fact that you de-risk the negotiation and you know exactly what to do. Usually what happens at that point is they pick up the phone, they call me and they say, "Hey, Scott, whatever we planned for, it went wrong." Great. All our other assumptions hold true? Yes. Thanks for the phone call. The more you understand what can go wrong, the more confident you'll be, the better you've shaped that table. So when you sit down at the table, the more effective you can be and the better outcome you can have.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And one of the things that I do in my work today, which is vastly different than when you and I met, is I work with executives. And we lean a lot into the elements of emotional intelligence. And one of the first steps of emotional intelligence, especially through Daniel Goleman, is this idea of self-awareness. And when I think about the program that I had with you, a lot of it was about understanding my own hot spots, you know, what could be my triggers, because believe it or not, people are going to try to push your buttons. They're going to try to get emotion out of you. If I didn't understand my own hot spots, my own triggers, but you did, I could be in trouble. How important is emotional intelligence, specifically self-awareness? How important is that in negotiations?
Okay, I can tell you till you're blue in the face, say you're a poker player, that you have a specific tell. Until you actually see or hear yourself do that, elicit that tell, you'll never believe you do it. We hear people say things like, you know, I could do something in the range of. What are you telling the other party? You're telling the other party you can go to the end of that range that's in their favor, whether it's the high end, the low rent, and depends if you're buying or selling. You've already shown them their movement. When you see people squirming in their chair, you're giving away a sign to the other party of how uncomfortable you are. Now, that could be how uncomfortable you are in the negotiation. It could be how uncomfortable you are with making a specific statement or a specific offer. But we hear it in the things you say, and we see it in the things you do. The more self-aware you are, the more you can control those outputs, the more you can control the words you use to make yourself firm in the offers you make and in the conversation you have. The more you control your nonverbal communication, the better off you'll be. The flip side of that is you can actually use the words you use and the actions you portray to send the messages to the other party that you want to send.
Like I said in the beginning, man, you are constantly in my head whenever I'm doing anything. If I'm negotiating for a car, I'm thinking of my time with you. If I'm trying to get my daughter to study for a test, I'm thinking of you. And, you know, I suspect that there are other executives that do this as well. How wide ranging would you say your clientele base has been from an industry perspective? Obviously, when I was with you, I was in consumer packaged goods. How wide ranging would you say your clientele has been?
Before I answer that question, I'd like to address one thing you just said, negotiating with your daughter. Everything we do at the Gap Partnership is about commercial negotiation. not for political negotiation. It's not for hostage negotiation. It's certainly not for spousal or familial negotiation. There are different power structures in the household.
Oh my gosh.
To be aware of.
So that must be why I lost every negotiation with my daughter that I've ever gone into. But Scott said, wait a second.
No. Scott, be very specific. Commercial negotiation. So to answer your question, our clientele runs the gamut. We work with 42 of the top 50 consumer goods companies in the world. We work with 8 of the top 9 retailers across the globe. We also work with over 300 of the global 500. It spans industry, it spans reach, it spans function within those organizations. So we work with oil and gas, industrials, financial companies, pretty much anything you name, we can delve into it. Then within our organization, we have different people who have different specializations. So for instance, if you had a labor negotiation coming up, and whatever side of the organization you're on, whether you're out for labor, for the employer, we've got people that do that.
Wow. Okay, so now I've got to ask, because this is something that's become incredibly clear to me, and I've had this conversation a couple of times this week already, that people, when they talk to me, especially people that have known me in my past life, they will say things like, Galen, you look totally different. I can tell that you found this thing that you believe you were built to do. And I get that all the time. And quite honestly, I do feel like I found my thing that I was put on this planet to do. This seems to be your thing. How do you determine that you go from being majoring in mathematics to this high level, you know, global salesperson, pharma, to you're the dude behind the curtain helping negotiators negotiate at the highest levels with the most complex deals? How do you determine that that is going to be your thing?
Oh, wow. That is a really challenging question. So for me, I didn't know. I walked into the Gap partnership and I thought I knew about negotiation until I started learning some of the philosophy that builds up to the things I was already doing. Now I sit there and I enjoy running a workshop every now and again for a client to help build the individual capabilities. But more often than not, I enjoy helping them solve challenges. My personality, I've done a gazillion of the personality assessments over the years, you name it. The irony is I've never done Myers-Briggs. All the other ones I think I've done. And when I sit back and I look at them, they all pretty much say the same thing, that I am high functioning in curiosity and I'm high functioning in ambiguity acceptance. My role is to take the challenging complex, the haze, the complex complexity we spoke of before. My role is to take that, make sense of it, and to help our clients do so. And I really enjoy that aspect of it, to help them solve their problems. Sometimes I'm in the room with them. Sometimes I've helped them solve them behind the scenes. My team is in the room with them. But either way, at the end of that, I recognize that I've taken them from point A as an organization to point F, G down the road to help them become more profitable.
Yeah. Wow. You know, and I'll tell you, you touched on something else that a lot of my clients, my business owners, entrepreneurs, they tend to struggle with. And that is going from being the person that's doing the thing to the person who's designing the organization for other people to do the thing. Because usually the way you find your way to being the head baker is because you bake a mean pound cake. But just because you bake a mean pound cake doesn't mean you're going to have what it takes to expand the business. How do you go from being the guy in the room to not being in the room all the time, but you're empowering other people to do what you did at a higher level?
Oh, wow. That is the million-dollar question, and I love a good pound cake every so often. Not very good for me, but I do love it. For me, I think early on in my Gap partnership career, I loved being the guy in front of the room, and the guy either running the workshop running a consulting project for a client. And to be fair, I still enjoy that from time to time. But I realize as I've grown through the organization that there are people that are better than me at doing that. They're in tune with everything that's going on in the marketplace, potentially more so than I am. And as a result, I realized that I love sitting in the room with a senior level executive, understanding what their challenges are, building some trust, credibility with that individual so that they'll open up to me, and figuring out a way to solve it. It was very much an awakening for me that I don't need to be the guy all the time, that I've got this team that's so much better than me.
Hey, it's not too late. Hit that subscribe button so you're sure to catch the next episode. If you're really enjoying the vibe, leave us a review or become a VIP for guest and show exclusives. Cheers.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.